Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 9th, 2002. Today's session is titled, How to Respond to Religious Nationalism and Conflict Resulting from the 9/11 Tragedy. Session 2, Fundamentalism and Religious Militancy, presented by Joe Bach. The number is BOJ2002-02. Let's listen in.
Well, good morning. I'm Joe Bach, and this is the second class of how to respond to religious nationalism and conflict resulting from the 9/11 tragedy. So the tape should begin. And I was told yesterday that I should give you a little bit of my background that I didn't really do during yesterday's class. I'd also like to do a bit of a review of some of the things that we went over yesterday. I want to talk a little bit more about the Milgram studies. That was a question that someone asked about yesterday. A bit about the phases of conflict and the phase that we're focusing on. And then I'm going to be asking you again if you have any experiences encountering bigotry or religious nationalism in your own lives, and I'm not going to let you off the hook. So you've got to share those, okay? So let's begin a little bit about my background. I'm currently working at American Refugee Committee in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We provide assistance to refugees in 13 different locations throughout the world, especially Africa, the Balkans, and now in Central Asia, and also in Thailand. We are a secular organization. Before I worked for American Refugee Committee, I worked for a faith-based organization, Catholic Relief Services, which is a little bit like Lutheran World Relief. You're probably familiar with Lutheran World Relief. And I worked for them for 3 years in the Middle East, based in Jerusalem, hence that's why I know the Thomases. And then before that, 3 years in Islamabad. And before that, for 2 years in their headquarters in Baltimore. While I was in Jerusalem, I was a visiting professor at Hebrew University. And while I worked in Islamabad, and for a little while when we were in Jerusalem, I had a fellowship with the Kellogg Foundation that paid for my research in especially India related to conflict between those of different faiths. On the basis of that, I have written a number of articles and the book that I showed you yesterday. My PhD is in international relations. It's from American University in Washington, D.C. And my master's and bachelor's are in social work, and I still feel like I'm a social worker. Mm-hmm. So that's my background. In terms of yesterday, let's just go over a few of the things that we went over. First of all, we defined bigotry as thinking our group is better than another group and being mean about it, sometimes to the point of violence. We defined religious, we talked about religious nationalism, but I didn't necessarily provide a definition. Let me do that right now. Thinking our religion is better than other religions to the point of exclusivity. It can lead to violence. It is a way of thinking that can definitely lead to violence. It isn't necessarily violent. And we talked yesterday about how this differs from patriotism. Nothing wrong with flying the flag. Nothing wrong with being proud that we're from our country, from America, or other people being proud of their country. There are questions about when you link up your religion with civil society and patriotism, if that does result in problems. We distinguish the difference between the third way, which is the choice that people make between fighting injustice physically to the point of using violence, and being passive, the third way being nonviolent direct action. And we compare that with stepping up, which is what I consider to be different than the third way, stepping up being a phenomenon on the spot, somebody resists aggression because they feel like it's the right thing to do, and they try to bring other people with them in resisting aggression. We used the example yesterday of a Hutu, moderate Hutu, standing in front of the home of a Tutsi as a violent Hutu mob was approaching. Those individuals who were standing up for the Tutsi family, and many of them did, and many of them died, but not all of them did. Some of them convinced the violent Hutu mob not to kill the Tutsi family. That is stepping up and leading a group of people who have been pulled into what we called yesterday this flashpoint asymmetry, where on the side of, in a sense, evil, you have the emotions of anger, fear, frustration, insecurity, disgust. And on the side of goodness, you have states of being. And there were some very good examples of on the side of goodness that were brought out yesterday by the group. But the fundamental problem that we face in standing up to religious nationalism, because of the emotional potency that they can access, especially using powerful religious symbols, is that on the side of goodness, we're dealing with some states of being that are difficult to compare in terms of their emotional potency. And I argued yesterday that it requires, in my opinion, it requires the power of the Holy Spirit, the power of God, to overcome that extremely acute potency in the other direction. You have a question?
Yes. Just for the sake of my own understanding, in the situation in the Middle East right now, where there are Israeli reservists refusing to serve the Israeli military in the occupation of the Palestinian lands, in your definitions, is that stepping up or is that third way?
I would say that was more of a third way, not more of a conscientious objection, a third way. Maybe requiring a different category, but because oftentimes a third way involves harm being done to oneself, and in fact, these soldiers probably are going to have to go to jail. So usually it involves a premeditated act where harm is going to be done to oneself as a way of making it clear to people that there is injustice in exposing.
And then stepping up would be a response to a current situation that I'm latching onto your premeditated act versus an immediate response or an emotive response to a situation that you're presented with, perhaps unexpectedly.
Right. It's not really premeditated, and so the moderate Hutu didn't really, you know, prepare him or herself to stand up on behalf of this Tutsi family. They did it, and they were willing to die to save that family.
Okay.
So I think it's a different phenomenon, not totally unrelated, but different.
Okay.
But one point that we did talk about yesterday, those are good questions, and please feel free to ask questions as we go along. One point that we talked about yesterday is that the Hutu-Tutsi example isn't necessarily completely the total picture of stepping up. In fact, it's a more dramatic example of it. I know people who are really good at stepping up when they hear a bigoted joke. And oftentimes you're in a social setting and it's uncomfortable to kind of say, oh, that really isn't appropriate, you know, and let me tell you why. It's uncomfortable to do that. It's awkward. You might hurt your friend's feelings. But they do it anyway because it's the right thing to do. So we need to distinguish between imminent violence and almost low-level aggression. Because it seems like, in many respects, having an ability to confront low-level aggression early can prevent the kind of social polarization that results in violence. And in some respects, that's almost more important that people really are able to do that. So in your community, if you have groups forming that are upset that there is a mosque in your hometown, and they're led by some Christian fundamentalist leader. Not that all fundamentalists are that way, but I'm just saying that a Christian fundamentalist leader, or by a group of skinheads who are doing this, what do you do at an early stage to try to turn that into an opportunity for people to celebrate the diversity of those Muslims in your community, rather than feeling like we need to shun them after 9/11? It really is important at even early stages, when that starts to happen, to try to confront it. In our society, where we have a well-developed code of law, civil liberties are mature. We have lots of legal means at our disposal, and generally speaking, we have professional police departments that can prevent violence. And we have the rule of law. Lots of places don't have that. So, in some respects, we are more able to prevent this sort of thing through the ways and means of government than a lot of places. But I just want to emphasize that really standing up to aggression at early stages is seems to be critical. And I learned this from some students in Jerusalem that did a lot of looking into some of the aggression that's going on in the Holy Land, the so-called Holy Land, and they found 5 different types of aggression in their research. There was let's call it electronic aggression on the web, on the internet, unbelievable amounts that they dug up, just fanatical websites. There was written aggression, flyers, that sort of thing that people were handing out when people were, for instance, leaving a synagogue or a mosque. There was verbal aggression over the loudspeakers at mosques or elsewhere. There was symbolic aggression, using symbols. For instance, there was one group that wanted to throw a pig's head on the Temple Mount and then invoke. You could argue that Sharon did a symbolic aggressive act and caused this current state, this current wave of violence. And the fifth one escapes my mind right now.
Physical aggression.
Which is
the one that's most obvious.
There we go. Right. Physical aggression. So it's interesting to look at all of those types of aggression. And there are, and we'll get into this throughout this week, but there are reasons why people don't confront aggression. I mean, we're going to be arguing by the fifth day of this week that more often than not, people would rather get involved in projects or programs where building interfaith harmony is the goal. And that's all well and good, and I don't want to sound critical of it. But in Jerusalem, these were happening all the time. And so it's kind of like, let's get everybody together, let's build interfaith harmony. But there was virtually no emphasis on how to arrest aggression, interfaith aggression, at early stages. So it's like the overwhelming amount of philanthropic investment is over here and virtually none up here, and it seems like up here is almost more important than over here. Why? And I think the answer to that is that it's much more pleasant to go to a wine and cheese party than it is to stand up to somebody who just said a bigoted joke. Or to develop some sort of a system where, and we'll talk about this later this week, where a religious leader with theological training confronts his or her co-religionists when they start becoming nationalistic. Often, sometimes, in a public way. So that the followers and potential followers of that leader are pulled in the direction of goodness rather than this negativity dominance, what psychologists call negativity dominance, which we talked about yesterday, on the negative side, those emotions on the side of the sword rather than the butter knife. It's not, religion isn't a double-edged sword. It doesn't seem like. Yes?
To what extent in this example you're giving right now, do you think that some of the root causes might be it's a lot easier for us as a society of people to agree on what is good and positive than we can agree on what is necessarily bad. In other words, a bigoted joke to one person might be, you know, a horrible offense.
Right.
Whereas to someone else, that's, you know, it's a little off color, it's a little distasteful,
right,
but it's not bad.
Right.
It doesn't require that. The social pain required to stand up to it is not significant enough to warrant standing up to it.
Right.
So we have this gray area. You talked about religion.
I think that's one reason why.
Religious nationalism.
Yeah.
At what point does religious nationalism become bad?
Right.
You know?
And it's hard to put a finger on that. And to stand up to it, sometimes you seem like an alarmist. It's a little, but it requires a certain discipline, a little bit like a good manager that identifies a problem with an employee and tries to coach that employee before it gets to the point of, okay, I'm putting you on probation. They go in and they coach that employee and say, you know, look, I see some problems here, you know. It's a little bit like that same sort of discipline that you have to have in the religious sphere, I think. Yes?
Well, there's this challenge that I see you talking about in terms of confronting it. How do you confront it without shaming the other person? So often you're put in a situation that if you confront it, especially in front of other people, that person feels humiliated.
Right.
And that's liable to polarize it further.
Exactly.
And
right,
you may be seen as an oppressor, politically correct,
right,
self-righteous, sort of a
right,
part of the problem.
Right.
And so there's a real subtlety about
right,
the way in which this is done.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. And there was some really interesting stuff written on the Balkans in terms of religious leaders who had formed alliances with politicians like Milosevic. And the fact that, first of all, in a psychological sense, some of them, because they did have theological training and were probably feeling cognitive inconsistency in doing what they were doing in view of the overwhelming peace tradition of their faith, that it was possible to go to them and to try to help them see the inconsistency of what they were doing in a private way. So it's a little bit a friend of mine and I recently wrote an article, and we call this nudging. So it's behind the scenes, it's probably private, and what you do is you walk in, for instance, and you say, you know those sermons you gave the other day, I was just thinking that, you know, maybe those would offend the Muslims, and have you given that any thought, or have you seen how, you know, President such and such has been using your sermon material lately, or what you wrote in the newspaper lately? Does that concern you at all? You see what I mean? So you deal with it in a private nudging way rather than what this friend of mine and I argued is, if it gets to the point where you can't kind of turn them around, then it becomes time for a theological duel publicly, because you've got to prevent them from accessing other potential followers. Mm-hmm. They may have a tightly knit group that's ideologically bound to that particular, often charismatic, religious nationalist. But there's a group of followers, potential followers, that they are not necessarily, haven't necessarily been pulled into it. And let me just put up, I just want to turn on this, and I see I've got a question back there, but let me just give you a graphic that I tried putting up. I decided to go ahead and do these overheads so that I could help you with.
Can you see that?
Is that better?
Yeah,
it's
better.
Okay.
But isn't there a way to focus
those?
Yeah, you can.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Up and down on the neck.
There we go.
Yeah.
That's.
Maybe it's covered in dust. We're good.
Can you see that?
Yeah.
No.
I can answer.
If anybody wants to move forward, I apologize if it's too small. Maybe we can move it further back. Would that be helpful? Okay.
Turn this lights off too.
Okay. That's a good idea.
Now we've got all kinds of ideas here.
So. The basic structure is here, and you were just talking about, you know, you do a nudging situation, and I want to clarify, and one of our goals for today is to talk a little bit about the findings of the Fundamentalism Project that was done under the auspices of the University of Chicago, led by Martin Marty, who many of you have, you know, famous Lutheran theologian, but also by Scott Appleby, who is now the head of the Kroc Institute for Peace at Notre Dame. Anyway, one of their findings was that you have to disaggregate this. The conflict-promoting authority figure usually is twofold in a religious situation. Oftentimes, a fundamentalist leader is not necessarily the one who is the one who has political influence. And one thing that they found that was really fascinating in the Fundamentalism Project is that sometimes religious leaders who are becoming religiously nationalistic don't necessarily want their theology to become, in a sense, hijacked by politicians who are using it for their own gain. There's an important distinction here, and I'll just make it, and then I'd like to get to your question. There's an important distinction here that I've read about in some recent documents that I want you to remember. It's a distinction between grievance and greed. Okay? Oftentimes, when there is injustice, there's a grievance, and there's a lot of, you know, social science research done. There's equity theory, there's relative deprivation theory, etc. All of that is based on grievance. We have a grievance. There's injustice, there's a grievance. We're going to stand up against the injustice, okay? So that results in violence. There's another more recent development in the social science literature where they really are starting to get an understanding that violence not only involves grievance, usually it requires real injustice in order to get a group of people to follow others. There's got to be some real genuine injustices there. Like, you could argue 9/11 was a result of how we've been treating the Palestinians in the Middle East. Some would say how we've been treating in the Muslim world. They're very frustrated about how we've been handling Iraq. They're very frustrated about our support of dictators in the Middle East. Those are the root causes, the grievance side of what results in violence. On the greed side, Well, those are the images that they're using. And there's enough of a, there's got to be at least enough of a grain of truth in that to be able to recruit people, your followers, your conflict-promoting followers. On the other side of that is greed. And what you get are certain people benefit, especially in some circumstances, like Milosevic, like some of these Hutu leaders that got this whole genocide organized. They had something to gain out of it. And those people tend to exploit the grievance to their advantage. And so they end up using, in a sense, fundamentalists when they're going to use religion because of its powerful emotional acceleration in people. They use religion and they exploit oftentimes fundamentalists, the rhetoric of fundamentalist religious leaders in doing that. And so this, in fact, should be disaggregated, and you should have a more of a civil society leader as compared to a religious figure who is helping, in a sense, whether knowingly or not. And if they're not, you know, if they're not knowingly doing it, the nudging opportunities are probably greater. And so you're able to maybe not prevent these people from following, but definitely from these people joining in at certain intervals in time, which we called flashpoints yesterday. Oftentimes during religious festivals, on holy days, and using certain religious symbols, like in Pakistan, you know, tear pages out of the Quran, throw them on the ground, and act like a Christian did it, or act like a Hindu did it, and you can incite violence between villages. So, I'm sorry I went on for a long time, and I know you had a question.
I'm still working on it, and maybe you covered this yesterday, and I wasn't here. The nudging idea, if it goes along with, you can only teach somebody something they already know, if that's not part of their operating system, the idea of resolving conflict or listening to other people, there's no motivation to participate in that. And I'm not saying that conflict is always bad. You look at marriage models, people who fight verbally don't always get divorced. That's just their style of resolving conflict.
Right.
So sometimes it works to get it out on the table and hash it through, but there are other people in my experience who have absolutely no interest in anybody else's viewpoint, and they know that they're right, and I don't know how we get through that. They buy into people who are looking for a simple answer, the power of being victimized, all that, and then that's where you get that controlling leader thing, but I have no idea how to break through that part of it.
Well, that's where I think you do go into the more public duel.
But you know, then you're just doing what you're doing.
Not necessarily. I mean, you're trying to fight hatred with love, and you're using...
They don't care. That doesn't make any difference.
Right.
But you're no longer trying to change their view. You're trying to show their potential followers.
But those potential followers, not the immediate followers.
Okay.
Yeah, you're trying to prevent these people from going over here rather than over here.
If those be on the fence people.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that tends to be usually the mass, you know, the mass numbers. And then you know, sometimes you need to deal with these people as criminals. Because they are. I mean, sometimes you don't have the rule of law, I understand that, but sometimes you have to treat those people as criminals who are prepared to do hate crimes.
It'd be nicer to just change the...
It would be. Sometimes it's not possible, right?
Well, I'm probably oversimplifying a lot, but I'm thinking now of 9/11 and the ensuing U.S. response, which I have problems with on a number of levels. But on a pragmatic level, the way in which we have responded, it seems to me, would be more fuel for the potential followers, as opposed to some other verbal duels publicly or also through the network of disenfranchised people in Pakistan and the surrounding region that could have undercut the potency of the message. Instead, we have fed right into those same, what they would expect, which would then, and seems to me, be an invitation for potential followers.
Right. You just set them with even a larger group of his victims.
Yeah.
Right.
It seems to me, anyway.
I like what you're saying. It seems pretty decisive, potentially, this difference between grievance and greed. Because if you have this public theological duel, you may be able to represent the potential followers who have a grievance and be able to engage in the sort of a love-filled conflict with the larger society that's causing the grievance while opposing the greed-based folks and sort of disaggregate that way. And in the 9/11 context, be able to speak the truth about the exploitation and deprivation that the desperation arose out of, while also confronting the greed and the power and the jealousy or the hatred.
That's right. This is based in part, if we could go back to part of our agenda for today. The Milgram experiments, I really looked into the whole issue of authority. Let me tell you a little bit about the Milgram experiments, because it's helpful to, it seems to me like there is symmetry in what we're calling this flashpoint asymmetry problem between the sharp-edged sword on the side of, you know, kind of negative emotions and more of a butter knife on the side of positive states of being that can be cultivated through religious means oftentimes. What I thought through was, wait a second, there's got to be some symmetry in authority, this authority figure, having the same potency with followers as this authority or potential followers. And let me tell you about the research that's been done on authority, some of it extremely startling. And it started years ago by some researchers at Stanford University, and someone asked about this yesterday, and I just want to make sure I follow up on this. In the Milgram experiments, research scientists used their authority with people who volunteered to be part of a study related to learning. The scientists were the authority figures in the experiment. The volunteers were the teachers, who were asked to electronically shock, quote, learners, end quote, actually Confederates in a scientific experiment, but the learners, for poor performance. The learners, okay, were Confederates. They pretended to get shocked when actually they were not. They would yell out in agony and ask for mercy. The key finding of the research, according to some recent social scientists, was that 65% of the teacher participants obeyed the experiment's orders that they shock, in steadily increasing magnitude, a protesting victim to the point of maximum punishment, a shock of the Confederate learner of 450 volts. The participants continued to exert shocks, thinking that they were actually hurting another human being substantially, despite feeling considerable stress during the process. This proved to be the case even with those who otherwise tended not to get rattled. As Milgram himself wrote, "I observed a mature and initially poised businessman enter the laboratory smiling and confident. Within 20 minutes, he was reduced to a twitching, stuttering wreck who was rapidly approaching a point of nervous collapse. He constantly pulled on his earlobe and twisted his hands. At one point, he pushed his fist into his forehead and muttered, 'Oh God, let's stop.' And yet he continued to respond to every word of the experimenter and obeyed to the end." Now, these studies have been criticized on
social psychological grounds, not to mention ethical grounds. But
those experiments were conducted in the 50s, 60s.
Yeah. I think it was the 50s. I'm not sure. I could check. I could get that answer for you, but I'm not sure off the top of my head. But what's been interesting, I mean, these studies have been applied to the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, Lieutenant Cowley. They've been applied to the Nazis. They've been applied most recently, and we talked about this a little bit yesterday, relative to torture by the Greek secret police relative to Cypriots in Cyprus. And what a lot of the research is showing, some of the more recent research is showing, is that on an organizational level, people often absolve themselves of personal responsibility and say that I'm in this system, and therefore it's a personal responsibility issue. But in any case, what I want to point out is why, when we've got this asymmetry, remember the sharp sword on the side in a sense of evil and the butter knife on the side of goodness, why is it, or why can it be, that a conflict-preventing authority figure, a religious leader, or anybody who takes their faith seriously and decides to do it, decides to step up in the face of aggression, why don't they have the same authority? And in the case of a religious leader, somebody who has legitimacy and credibility in their faith community, and through that brings about obedience in the conflict preventing followers and potentially the potential followers. In other words, there may be some symmetry here from the standpoint of authority, but I don't think, and this is a point we talked about yesterday, this was a social psychological study, the Milgram experiments and the subsequent research. I don't think that religious leadership only involves social psychology. I think it involves God. And I think that's where you get to the question of the spiritual phenomena that take place when people have the guts to stand up for others who are victims in terms of aggression or violence, physical violence, and other types of aggression. Now, I also wanted to talk today a little bit, and I'll put up another overhead here, in terms of the stage of violence that we're talking about, it is important to clarify that. Let me try to adjust this. Sorry, it's not real clear, is it?
It's really quite straight on.
It's what?
It's probably not facing. The projector is probably not quite straight. So it's different distances.
Oh, I see. Okay. It doesn't seem to solve it. Well, let me just point out that, and I'll read through this. What we've got pre-violence, and then we've got post-violence, and then we've got what I refer oftentimes to ethno-religious violence, because oftentimes people link together their ethnicity with their religion. In fact, Scott Appleby, this co-director of the Fundamentalism Project, calls it ethno-religious violence. Okay, so pre-violence, ethno-religious violence, in other words, during violence and then post-violence, stable relations. Unstable relations where we're demonizing, we're scapegoating. The skinheads are saying, how can we stand to have this mosque in our community? I don't want to hear this call to prayer five times a day on this loudspeaker in my neighborhood. This is America. Okay? manipulated crisis. Okay, we talked about grievance versus greed. It's manipulating a crisis. It happens in many ways. There are two researchers at University of Chicago, they're a husband and wife team, Rudolph and Rudolph. They have documented in other countries, particularly in India, how history is reinvented. In the Balkans, we've had evidence of people actually burying memorials of when the Serbs and the Croats did something together, positively. They destroy the evidence. They reinvent history.
Like in Algeria, in France, and entire wealth of like information on torture is just manipulated to see if it was Muslim on Muslim torture when it was really the French military.
Okay. So it's a matter of, you know, we talked about grievance versus greed. The people involved in gaining from violence, they manipulate it. And you know, I use the term violence engineering. Other places I've seen the concept of conflict entrepreneurs. Okay? Now in India, you can go out, just like in America, you can go out and hire a campaign consultant to help throw mud at your opponent in a campaign. It's legal. And it's done all the time. In India, you can go hire people to start a riot for you. If you want to make the people in power appear to, that they can't govern, you can go out and hire people like that. And they don't always get money. Sometimes they get sex, they get drugs, whatever. So there are literally people who have professionalized violence engineering. Now, I'm not saying that that's the case here. You may have certain, you know, skinhead groups where you've got people who go around and conjure up trouble. I really don't know. I don't know the U.S. context that well. Then you've got post-violence reconstruction, and then you've got reconciliation back down to stable relations, okay? And what I want to emphasize is that what we're talking about is this domain right here during these 5 days. Over here, the whole domain of reconciling after conflict, there are a lot of great theologians who have really developed that well. And some particularly applied theologians, we talked about Robert Schreier the other day, who have really done a great job with that. This is the area that we're focused on. And oftentimes in the social science and political science literature, they look at this in a linear way. And the students that we had involved in what we called an anti-incitement project in Jerusalem, from Hebrew, Hebron, and Bethlehem universities, an equal number of Christians, Jews, and Muslims, an equal number of Palestinians and Israelis, they help me see that you can't deal with it on a linear, you can't look at it in a linear way. You've got to look at it in a circular way. You've got to look at aggression. And you can't have certain interventions to prevent violence in a preemptive mode. You've got to try to deal with aggression all the time. You can't look at it in a linear way.
In the five categories of aggression that you detailed earlier,
right?
Was there any attempt in that study to delineate those categories of aggression in terms of government-sponsored public policy aggression versus what I'll call community-based. In other words, I see all five categories operating in the public policy
positions of both the State of Israel and the Palestinian Authority. I also see the potential for all five categories to be operating on a more grassroots level in terms of just the populace of both those constituencies.
The link,
I was wondering if in the study there was any delineation of that in terms of its efficacy or in terms of how to deal with it.
It's an excellent question, and this particular project involved in the anti-incitement project did not really get into that in any detail. The best thing that I'm actually reading it right now, the best thing that I've read on that, because it's very subtle. Oftentimes the linkages between the kind of religious nationalist groups that are bordering on violence and the politicians, it's a very subtle sort of relationship.
Sometimes it's subtle.
Yeah, sometimes it's not. but it's important to understand the subtleties. And this is the best book. I'll recommend this. Paul Brass's Theft of an Idol. It's on India. This is what I mentioned last night, Barbara. I'm not done with it. But this is a great book.
Who is it?
Paul Brass. He's a professor at University of Washington here in this state. He is an unbelievable writer. He studied India for a year and this type of violence. And you know how we talked about religious symbolism or religious aggression? The idol was stolen. It was the aggressive act designed to promote violence, and it did. That's why he named the book Theft of an Idol. He's got five different case studies in here of that type of manipulation, violence engineering, conflict entrepreneurs. So I highly recommend it. So what I need to ask you now is, what have been your experiences with religious nationalism or with bigotry? Or are there things in your communities where people are starting to wonder, what is this idea of tolerance all about? Should we really get along with Muslims? Are they inherently aggressive? Are they inherently hateful towards the West? Have you encountered that? And if so, how are you responding to it? Would anyone like to share their experience or experiences? Yes.
I can give a start. My experience is based, the experience I'm drawing on right now is based in having spent considerable amount of time traveling, and in particular 5 months living in the Middle East, in Amman, Jordan, working as a journalist, and from there traveling into Lebanon and into Israel, into Egypt and through Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Pakistan. This was in the mid-80s. And one of the things that was very interesting to me, being based in Amman, Jordan, as opposed to being in Israel or in Jerusalem, was an opportunity to get to know Muslims on a different level. I wasn't in the midst of a conflict situation. I wasn't in a heightened security environment, etc. And I went in with some level of expectation that because I was an American, I was going to be treated with some measure of, if not hostility, at least reservation, etc. And instead what I found was the real yearning and desire for almost everyone I came in contact with in the Middle East, with almost every Muslim I came in contact with in the Middle East, to show me what a peace-loving people they were. And I had the opportunity to get to know a couple people very well,
and at one point as we were sitting down having tea, and this was a regular occurrence, we walking down the street and just be invited in to come in and have tea and talk. We were sitting having afternoon tea, and I said, you know, I'm really confused by this because it's totally different than my expectations when I arrived. And his response to me was that that Americans in general don't know Muslims, and that in general their perception of Muslims is created by our understanding of our understanding in the press, the label of terrorists and the PLO and Yasser Arafat, and so that which we it's contextualized in the frame of the Palestinian-Israeli conflicts. And so there's this perception that all Muslims are bad. And our hope is that you will see that we're not, A, and B, that you'll tell people when you get back to your country of the experiences that you've had and that we're not, you know, this way as we're represented in the press. And it was quite an eye-opening experience. And then when I did go to Israel, I had an opportunity to go to a party at someone's house. I was invited by an Israeli friend, and when I got there, I was even more shocked to see a number of Palestinians and Israelis all together in this party, and they were mid-20s, and you know, they all said that if their parents knew that they hung out together and you know, socialized with one another, they would be, you know, in our language, grounded or, you know, separated. But that they saw this was their effort to be more peaceful. To learn to live together was to socialize with one another, to hang out, to go dancing, and whatnot. Again, an eye-opening shock to me. So I just wanted to offer that up as an interesting experience that I had that completely reframed a lot of how I look at what goes on in the Middle East.
It's very helpful. It's the type of thing that we need to understand better, I think, in this country in the wake of 9/11. And that message, in a sense, that's a social explanation, I think, of what needs to come out from either, you know, friends or civic leaders or religious leaders, that, you know, you need to understand that you can't stereotype that all Muslims are this way.
No. But I guess I had one other thing that really sort of influences and affects my particular lenses through which I look at our foreign policy, and that was that I went into Afghanistan with the Mujahideen when it was occupied by the Soviets. I was in and out on three different occasions, and on my first trip in, I'm just really making the story a lot shorter than it is, but on my first trip in, I was in this home. There were 13 Mujahideen men and myself, and I was asleep, you know, sort of asleep. It was late, and the leader came into me and woke me up and said that they had been having a meeting out in the other room, and that they all knew that my value to them, on a financial level, if they were to turn me over to the Soviets, that I was worth about $10,000 to them, which in that country at that particular time was a whole lot of money. And they were all very well aware of that, the financial value of turning me over to the Soviets inside Afghanistan. But that they wanted me to know that they had collectively met and unanimously decided that every one of them would have to be killed before I could be captured. Which was just a humbling experience.
I have a couple of other positive stories. I'm much smaller scale.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. It's much more prosaic.
I live in Spokane, Washington. I don't know if there's anybody else here who lives there or near there. So if you do, maybe you have other experiences that you could compare my stories with. But I was really impressed with the fact that right after 9/11, our mayor made a very public event to go the following Sunday, or maybe, I can't remember, weekend, whatever their holy day is, and worship at the mosque. There was a lot of media coverage of that, and he made a very public statement that this is what he expected everyone else in the city to do. He's Catholic. And it just that we're not going to stand for this in our town, which is kind of interesting. Being close to Northern Idaho, a lot of people think of the area as a lot of skinhead, conservative, white supremacists, and certainly they're there. But I think that the groups in Montana and Idaho that are trying to quash that have really had an impact, and that the general public is rising up and saying, this kind of attitude doesn't work for us.
Right.
Keep it to yourself, but don't do that where we can see it. We don't want you to pray down our street, and we don't want to see you. We don't want to hear you. And just at a much even smaller scale, there's a Middle Eastern restaurant in town that my husband and I like to go to, and they said that right after 9/11, their business really dropped off. But pretty soon they began to realize that was because all business really dropped off. Everybody just stayed home for a while and tried to figure out what was going on. But then the people that went there sometimes started coming there really often to try to show their support and say, you know what, we know you guys make great food, you know, you're really good hosts and we like you, and he's from Jordan, she looks like she would be Middle Eastern, but she actually grew up in Los Angeles.
I think there's the overwhelming trend seems to have been in that direction. With the, you know, more of the, probably the sort of skinhead type of activity increasing as well, but the vast majority of it has been a very very positive reaction. We have an Afghan restaurant in the Twin Cities, and they've had an enormous degree of support.
Cambridge, too. Cambridge, Massachusetts. I mean, Cambridge is dubbed the People's Republic of Cambridge, so I live kind of in an odd world where I'm like listening to what other people are saying, what everybody else is saying. I'm like, I don't know anybody who thinks that.
Right.
I was thinking of a more prosaic experience that again happened a number of years ago, but I was walking down the street with an Iranian friend and a couple of kids, like 11, 12 year olds, taunted him in ways that I was like, hey, wait! I mean, it was totally eye opening for me that he had to experience that kind of crap all the time. My response was indignation, you know, to go up and tell those kids to shut up and be more respectful of people. But he definitely did not want that, so I respected what he wanted there. But it is. I think it is a kind of an issue where like-minded people tend to gravitate to one another, and it's sometimes hard to imagine where other people are thinking. That's sometimes hard to.
In Seattle, the Christians went and sat at the mosque outside. They just sat there.
Protecting it.
And they were going to, they did, I think, get some graffiti or something right away quick. And that's what they did. They just went to the mosque and sat there. They didn't worship there. They just went and sat there in front of the mosque. And said, here is my body, and you're not messing up this place. So I thought that was pretty neat.
A great example of what we talked about yesterday as a preemptive sort of approach, preventing it from happening. I mean, you're there, the tension is high, and you're putting your body on the line, basically.
Right. And they were all age people that were doing it, too.
That's really beautiful.
They actually, that was on, I don't know if it's on the front page or the the main second section, that there was a big picture in the Tacoma paper about mm-hmm. that, and that's pretty cool, I think. We have a mosque, and I don't know if they got trashed or not, but I drive by there almost at least two or three times a week, and I've never seen graffiti on their fence, and I don't, and it's a high kind of a wall thing with some little figures at the end that have faces on four sides, and then you can see the building in the back with a pretty roof and everything, and it's very nice, and I don't think the neighbors are trashing that one out. Mm. It's off kind of in the east side of Tacoma, not, you know, it's not on a busy street. It's just, it's kind of, sure. It's in a residential area, and there was conflict when it was built.
Uh-huh.
They were worried, but it doesn't seem to bother anybody.
I said two quick stories of things that are a little more concerning. One is a friend of ours' daughter is in high school, and early on after 9/11, when we began the bombing, the teacher in her, you know, I'm not sure what class it was, had a debate on who was in favor of what the U.S. policy was and who was against it. She ended up being the only person speaking against it. She was she's a young pacifist and growing in that belief, and she became attacked in the room, and the teacher upheld that, I mean verbally attacked, right. And felt humiliated, and it became an issue in her school, and only her parents discussed it with the teacher, and it was alleviated, and the girl was strong enough that life continued. But that was very important. And then also our son Nicholas, we went to visit the Middle East, or Jerusalem, during Holy Week. And he came back. He's been very reserved about speaking what he feels, because he doesn't want to speak out. And he did speak out. And his teacher likewise came back and said, well, you don't realize, listen, what's happening in the press. Israel has a right to do whatever it needs to. And Nicholas came home and said, I just don't have the words, the vocabulary. And that was very awkward for him. We ended up writing a letter, and it ended up, the teacher never talked again with our son. Which was unfortunate, but he did communicate with us the last day of school, which was nice. I mean, that kind of thinking that we hear in our press then gets translated in our schools and gets picked up with our kids, and there's not necessarily room for free debate. In our press, I think still there hasn't been good room for debate of alternative views. And I don't know where that fits in with all of that, but that's an important part, is to have some different expression. Alternatives.
I was reading an article in a magazine, and it was talking about the people who lost someone in 9/11 in New York, and they were marching, you know, for a different response than retaliation. Only what had happened was they cut off all of the protest signs and just said that they were marching for something else, you know,
press coverage.
Oh, wow. And it's kind of scary.
Well, we're running out of time. Why don't we've got one more example. I'm afraid we're going over our hour limit here.
This isn't an example, so you can just drop it if you want. If it's more of a question. You were talking about the city grantee and they wanted you to know that those people. Do the people there hear the stories here, the support that's here, that they just see our government's actions?
So who's that directed at?
Anybody who knows the answer.
I think that the people in crisis in the Middle East, you know, most of them had a strong feeling that they like Americans, they don't like the American government or the American government's policies. That wasn't always the case in Pakistan. There was a much more, I mean, they had gone through the trauma of a military dictatorship that turned into a fundamentalist, torturous entity. And they many of them did view America as, you know, the land of risque behavior, lacking morality, in which in some respects it is. And yet I think they loved a lot of, you know, they liked the American people that they encountered, but they did kind of see it as Sodom and Gomorrah.
But there's some compassion here and some awareness. I'm not saying it's all prevailing, but it's here and there.
And I guess I'd add to that that the more educated the person that you were talking to, the better their understanding of American society and their understanding of the delineation between government policy and public public feeling, public, you know, emotion. That and so there was a in my experience anyway, there was a, if you were talking with people that had not had much international exposure, much education, you know, educated at much lower levels, they were much more readily persuaded by the leadership that was looking to incite violence and you know, label the U.S. as a demagogue and whatnot than those who had more broader educational experience. That was again, that was true in the Middle East as well as in Pakistan.
I have a real problem with that. The first time I heard that, and I was thinking of it when you were talking about it, and that is, how can you say that our government policies are different from our people? We are the government. We vote those folks in that make those decisions, and those are our decisions, and I don't see any difference between our government and us.
I think there's a huge difference because it's a republic, it's not a direct democracy.
That may be the case, but nevertheless, we put those people in, we get exactly what we want.
There's a lot of money.
But it doesn't get it.
There is a lot of money. We put our money where our mouth
but
is.
My point here is that everybody doesn't get exactly what they want.
That's true.
And so there's a huge population base in the United States that does not feel that its government's actions.
It's our fault, isn't it?
No, I'm not. All I'm saying is that there is a there are disparities between the way the government acts and the way members of the population feel.
Why?
Because we're not a unanimous society.
Why don't we vote for the people we want then?
Can I speak from a Canadian perspective?
That'd be great.
Oh, he's got a Canadian idea. Okay.
Yeah. Your country's split right down the middle.
Yes, it is.
So half would be for, and half definitely would be against.
I agree.
I think in the numbers of your last election, however rigged that was, I don't want to get into that, but definitely I think that it's 7, and you're not going to get clarity in the next 4 years.
And one question was just, did the people in the Middle East know that there is this dichotomy?
I can speak to it as of last March. You have to remember that they're seeing our weapons being used against the Palestinians, people in Afghanistan. They're seeing it. They're starting to stop separating. I've never heard so much anger and frustration, very polite anger and frustration, but very strong anger and frustration nonetheless. They're seeing our president on CNN talking, now labeling their whole country as terrorists. These are regular working people, people who can't go to the Y to play basketball. This man saying, look how heavy I've gotten. I can't even go out and walk with my wife at night anymore. We hear about the Israeli fear. We don't hear about the everyday Palestinian fear. And I can't even imagine what it's like in Afghanistan and Pakistan right now. But I think that those distinctions are becoming blurred because they're so frustrated. If it's so clear our pain, why don't you hear it? And they say, if you're a Christian nation, why is your president doing this and saying this or not saying this? And I've never heard that before. I'm not a seasoned expert, but we've been 6 years overseas. And
and that's a bit of time.
That's a good question. Why is he?
But anyway, I feel like I have to say that because we were there in Holton, seeing what they were seeing on TV did not match what my kids experienced. My son saying, why doesn't President Bush have advisors here telling him what's going on? Mm-hmm. That was a really painful civic lesson.
By the way, I know we need to we're over in terms of time, but I do want to mention that this is my wife, Sue. she's my best friend. And some of the research that I did, she and I wrote two of the case studies together, and she has a lot of knowledge about this thing as well. So
I'm emotional. I'm not
emotional.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And
they have a forum on some of this stuff Wednesday night, right?
Right.
Wednesday night, oh, good. That's great.
Thanks,
Laura.
Enjoy the view on tomorrow.